From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, the Attorney General scandal competed for airtime with captive sailors, a British crew that may or may not have trespassed in Iranian waters. Among them, leading seaman Faye Turney, featured on Iranian TV in a headscarf praising her captors.
Obviously, we trespassed into their waters. They were very friendly, very hospitable.
On Thursday, we spoke to Matt Wells, media critic for The Guardian newspaper. He says anti-Muslim sentiment has been inflamed since the terrorist attacks in London 2 years ago. So the symbolism of a British sailor mum paraded before the world in a hijab sent the tabloid press into an ecstasy of rage, starting with the Daily Mail.
It's quite clear what they're trying to do. There's a picture of the female service personnel next to a long banner headline which says, "A British mother paraded on state TV, forced to wear the hijab, made to praise her Iranian kidnappers," and the response from our mighty Foreign Office, "This is unacceptable," they squeaked. So, I mean, that's quite a clever way of bringing together all sorts of different issues in the one headline. Today's Daily Express, which is fighting for the same kind of middle market readership as the Daily Mail, has the same picture, and its headline is "Forced to wear a Muslim scarf, how Iran paraded a British hostage." So again, they're highlighting the Muslim scarf issue. The other papers, the Daily Mirror, "Outrage" is its big headline. Again, the same picture. "A young mum paraded like a trophy on TV, forced by the cowards of Iran to lie about how she and 14 British servicemen were taken hostage." So similar imagery there.
Would you say that the tabloids are expressing the kind of collective zeitgeist? And is the anger being evenly split between Iran and Tony Blair?
Yeah, I think there's a fairly even split of anger because there are plenty of villains in this piece. And, you know, the British tabloid press is very clever. It knows its market very well. It knows what the fears of it and prejudices and concerns of its readership are. That's why these papers sell millions of copies every day. And it has to be said that, you know, most of Britain, most of white middle class Britain is worried about these kinds of multicultural issues since the July 7th bombings, you know, is concerned about the attitude of Muslims towards them. And when they see women clad from head to toe in black burqas, it's frightening. And so these kinds of headlines play on these fears that people have. You know, whether these fears are genuine or not, the fact is that this is what people feel. And the press is quite clever to play on those fears for quite nakedly commercial gain in order to sell more newspapers.
But what about the more left-leaning press? How about your newspaper, The Guardian or The Independent?
The Guardian, the Independent and the Times, the kind of the more serious end of the market, the heavies as we like to call them, are giving it a bit more balance. In these papers, there is more nuanced coverage, but I have to say there's not much nuance in the bottom end of the market.
But do they have the story essentially right, or are there some wrong facts that seem to recur in the tabloid press, the bottom end?
Well, yeah, it's certainly the case that facts don't get in the way of a good story. Take the headline in the Daily Mail that said that Faye Turney was paraded on state TV. Well, it's not the case. Actually, her pictures were shown on a rather obscure satellite channel that is linked to the Revolutionary Guards and which broadcasts in Arabic. Most people in Iran don't speak Arabic, they speak Farsi. That channel is watched, I understand, more in Iraq than Iran. And our correspondent in Tehran has been saying that this story really isn't getting much coverage within Iran at all, and most Iranian people are not aware of it.
Matt, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Matt Wells is the media editor for The Guardian.
The storm over the firing of 8 U.S. attorneys continues to swirl in Washington. On Thursday, senators grilled former Justice Department operative D. Kyle Sampson, who said that his boss, Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez, did have a direct hand in the dismissals. Gonzalez had earlier claimed he wasn't personally involved, and on that point, the paper trail didn't contradict him, because in all the thousands of pages of emails released by the White House so far, there's not one email from the Attorney General himself. Apparently, he doesn't use email. And he's not the only cabinet official. Donald Rumsfeld claimed not to use it, ditto for Condoleezza Rice and Michael Chertoff. In fact, the president himself told CNBC last year that he didn't touch the stuff.
I tend not to email. Well, not only tend not to email, I don't email because of the different record requests that could happen to a president. I don't want to receive emails because, you know, there's no telling what somebody would email me and then it would show up as, a part of some kind of a story. And I would be able to say, well, I didn't read the email, but I sent it to your address. I can say you didn't. So in other words, I'm very cautious about emailing.
In the wake of the prosecutor purge, some are questioning whether Bush and his staffers are really steering clear of email altogether or just their official White House accounts. Recently released documents show that one aide to Karl Rove helped orchestrate the firings using an account registered to the Republican National Committee. And Rove himself reportedly uses his RNC account for about 95% of his emailing. The watchdog group Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington doesn't like the looks of that one bit and has asked Congress to investigate. I'm joined now by the group's top watchdog, Melanie Sloan. Melanie, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you.
So let's just say White House staffers are routinely using outside accounts. Is there any legal responsibility to use their government-issued email accounts?
There is, in fact. There's something called the Presidential Records Act that requires individuals who are employed in the White House by the Executive Office of the President to maintain all communications, all email correspondence. And if you are not using a White House account, which has an automatic backup system, then you are, in fact, in violation of the Presidential Records Act.
But my understanding of the law was that there is no explicit mandate to use only White House email accounts for official communication?
Well, that's an interesting question. We sent a letter over to the Office of Administration in the Executive Office of the President to ask about their policies. There was, in fact, a very explicit policy in the Clinton administration specifically prohibiting staff from using commercial email systems.
Irrespective of whether it's actually illegal, can we assume that this is being done in order to evade the requirement?
We can be sure that it's being done to evade the requirement because we've seen emails that so indicate. There was some correspondence with Jack Abramoff back in 2003 where he said he had accidentally sent an email to Susan Ralston, who was a former assistant to Karl Rove, on her White House account, and that was a mistake. They didn't want to end up with emails being preserved. Even today, I read something where a bunch of White House staff have expressed concern that it's coming out that they were using RNC email accounts. So a couple have gone out and gotten their own BlackBerries with private email accounts, as if somehow that's the solution. That's just another way that they're evading the law, again, which requires all emails from White House staffers to be maintained.
Melanie Sloan is Executive Director of the Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. The White House didn't return our calls for comment on this matter of executive record keeping, but Anna Nelson did. She's a presidential historian at American University. Back in the 70s, she worked on a governmental commission that helped draft the Presidential Records Act, invoked by Melanie Sloan in connection with the White House email. Nelson says that before Richard Nixon, presidents and their heirs had willingly donated their papers to the National Archives, eventually. But when Watergate happened, Congress had to intervene to keep the president from destroying his records.
He was about to throw his tapes in the Potomac. Then suddenly it occurred to people that while presidents had been so good about giving their papers, they didn't have to. They could give whatever they wanted. There was no view that the papers that they owned were public papers. And it was out of that that the Congress put together the Presidential Records Act,
which I guess had two basic provisions. One, that records from the White House were to be protected and not destroyed, and that they be released within a reasonable amount of time of a president leaving office. The period of time specified was 12 years. Why 12 years?
I think it was an arbitrary number. You can look at it from the standpoint that three elections down the road, they'll open the papers of a past president.
Well, this gets to Presidential Executive Order 13233, signed by President Bush in 2001. Tell me what the order says and what it has hindered journalists and historians from doing.
This order has a couple of provisions. One is that whereas the Presidential Records Act deliberately did not allow heirs or family members of any kind or executors to decide in the future what was going to be released, this provision on the Bush Act does allow, in perpetuity, actually, there's no restriction, for the president's heirs or executors to determine whether or not things can be opened or not. The second thing is that there is no deadline for the current president to actually decide on whether a paper can be released. So as far as journalists are concerned, your story is long going to be over before you see any papers under this executive order.
So is it fair to say that President Bush, by executive fiat, negated the Records Act and sent us back to the pre-1978 ways of doing business?
He sent us back in access. Of course, the papers are still government-owned papers. He didn't deny that, so that the government can still protect them. When we get to see them is the issue.
The House of Representatives 2 weeks ago approved a measure that would, in fact, overturn President Bush's executive order. Assuming the Senate does the same and this results in a bill being placed on the president's desk, do you expect him to sign that bill into law?
I think he'll work very hard to keep the Senate from passing it. I think if it's passed, that he may veto it. But it would not be a very smart politically because, I mean, how are you going to explain to the American people that you don't want to open records, that you don't want to tell them what you did, or you don't want to tell them what your father did, or you want all the presidents who follow you not to be able to tell us what goes on? That's going to be tough to explain. It's more involved than that, but you know that's the way it's going to come out.
Anna, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Anna Nelson is the Distinguished Historian in Residence at American University in Washington, D.C.
Coming up, why early primaries are good, bad, and ugly, and cancer as a cultural touchstone.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. It's spring in Washington, and that means two things, cherry blossoms and press banquets. Here's President Bush entertaining the radio and television correspondents' dinner.
Press is a lot tougher the second term. It's reached the point I sometimes call on Helen Thomas just to hear a friendly voice.
The journalists laughed, the politicos laughed, elbow to elbow, and unadversarial, at least for one night. Or longer. In 2003, at a similar black tie affair, the Boston Globe's Deputy Washington Bureau Chief Nina Easton hit it off with Republican strategist Russell Schrieffer. Now, Easton is Washington Bureau Chief for Fortune magazine and an analyst on Fox News, and Schrieffer, a media advisor to the John McCain campaign, is her husband. Their union was one of several highlighted in a Los Angeles Times piece last week about marriages between Washington journalists and campaign staffers. Marriage, of course, is potentially the ultimate conflict of interest, but Easton says romantic entanglements between the coverers and the covered are just a fact of life in Washington, D.C.
Andrea Mitchell is married to Alan Greenspan. You've got, you know, top newscasters married to campaign people. You have also, particularly on the Democratic side, there's reporters who are very close friends with Democratic strategists, who vacation with them, who, you know, have dinner parties with them, whose spouses go on carpools together. But I think all of us in Washington who do this, we have our reputations to protect.
So tell me how you and your editors at Fortune decided to proceed here. Clearly, there is the possibility for at least the perception of conflict of interest. How are you dealing with it?
You know, I write about politics and economics, and we decided that I would not cover anything related to McCain. My other venue is Fox News. Those tend to be more freewheeling panels, and so sometimes a subject that's directly McCain-related will come my way. And in that case, Britt Hume and I decided that when it does come up and it is appropriate, it would be best to disclose it. I think disclosure is the great disinfectant.
I want to pull back here a little bit. According to your wedding announcement in the New York Times, you and your husband met at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. And a lot of people, me included, believe me, have criticized that event for the coziness that I think it's fair to say it celebrates between political reporters and the people they cover in government. What are your feelings? I mean, apart from the fact that you met your beloved there, what are your feelings about the event and just the larger issue of coziness?
You know, it's interesting. I mean, I think a lot of navel-gazing media analysts like to worry about this coziness issue. I think the reporters who cover a lot of the sources who turn up at the White House Correspondents' Dinner are, you know, quite tough on them afterwards. A lot of, let's say, Bush officials have been at that event, and I don't think the press has been particularly easy on the Bush White House. So, you know, I think you kind of overestimate what those kinds of events do. What they do is enable people to see each other as human beings, which I think in this town doesn't always happen.
I'm sorry. I was gazing at my navel. I lost the thread of what you were saying. Obviously, reporters, many of them, you know, are people too. And they have relationships and they fall in love and they get married, you know, just like other people do. On the other hand, the public has shown again and again that it's trust for journalists is diminishing over the years, and they're very suspicious of hidden agendas and so on.
When you say suspicion about the media, you know, it's not just, you know, reporters are cozy with sources and everything. A lot of the suspicion comes from people who feel unfairly covered. A lot of people feel like the press is unfair. And I would say it's actually a bonus for me to watch somebody in my house go through the experience of having a candidate covered and see where it's fair and where it's not fair. You start looking at coverage through the eyes of people who are being covered. And if anything, I think a combination of that, you know, seeing what it's like to be covered day in and day out, A, and B, a sense that I have to be extra careful, I have to bend over backwards to be fair, I think it continues to train me to be more fair and to be more careful about the people that I'm covering.
Well, Nina, thank you so very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Nina Easton is Washington Bureau Chief for Fortune Magazine and an analyst for Fox News. In campaign news outside the Beltway, states across the country are scurrying to move their presidential primaries earlier in the year to February 5th, 2008. Call it Super Duper Tuesday. 8 states are currently slotted for that day, and 16 more may follow suit. It's an attempt to steal some political clout from the traditional golden children of the primary season, Iowa and New Hampshire. Some say the new date will force candidates to pay attention to states they traditionally ignore. Others say there's nothing super or, in fact, duper about it. But how will the change affect coverage? Will there be no more datelines from the Iowa coffee shop, the proverbial New Hampshire knitting circle? Wayne Slater is a political reporter for the Dallas Morning News, and he joins us now. Wayne, welcome to OTM.
Great to be with you, Bob.
Now, as one of the inveterate boys on the bus, your job has been to follow these candidates around for weeks and months. How does this change your job?
Obviously, I like the idea of Texas moving its primary to February because, in part, it requires these candidates to come down here. We might be a state that the candidates come to raise money, Texas, for example, New York, California. But when it comes to actually engaging the voters, these candidates focus most of their attention in the primary season on Iowa, New Hampshire, Michigan, South Carolina. So far this year, all the candidates have come through Texas, and I rarely am able to talk to them.
Well, congratulations, Willie Loman. Attention is being paid to your Texas, and I guess that gives you an opportunity for local reporting. But what do you lose during the rest of the campaign, journalistically, if the whole shooting match is over in February?
Well, you know, once upon a time, and it wasn't that long ago, you had a whole series of primaries where you had a campaign narrative that developed over time. And journalistically, not only were we able to follow this narrative, somebody's up, somebody's down, somebody makes a mistake, somebody says something great, and we can be criticized for following the horse race, but it was actually the development of these candidates, watch them answer questions, watch them engage with the voters over an extended period of months. Now, the threat is, for those who don't like this idea, it's going to be over so quickly, you really have no time to do this. If you have a situation where you have 24 states all having their primary on the same day, you're not going to see these candidates in all of those states. What you're going to see is a lot of television commercials.
You're saying that this whole thing could backfire?
I think it could backfire. And one of the arguments of the opponents of this move in a state like mine in Texas is that if after it is over on February 6th, one or both parties still don't have a nominee, then those states which haven't joined the crowd are really going to be premium opportunities where the candidates will have to really pay attention.
Kingmaker states.
Absolutely. You could see Texas or some other state a week or 2 weeks or a month later becoming the ultimate state that a nominee would have to have. And let me tell you, whatever state it would be, would see all these candidates like they've never seen them before.
I'm curious, have the state's large newspapers, including yours, editorialized for or against moving the primary?
All politics is local, and the editorials that I've seen, including ours so far, are supportive of the idea of moving the process. In Texas, we tend to think whatever's good for Texas is good for America. There is, I think, a sense that if we can be a bigger player in this process, then we can help not only pick the nominee in a fundamental way, but we can affect the debate. Republicans will talk about immigration in New Hampshire and Iowa in one way. But you go to South Texas, near the Mexico border, you really have the potential to have a different kind of debate. Not that they change their mind on issues, but you have a constituency that says, do you really understand the ramifications, Republican or Democrat, of what it is you're proposing and you're for?
All right, Wayne. Well, thank you so much.
Good to be with you.
Wayne Slater is a senior political reporter for the Dallas Morning News. He is co-author with James Moore of The Architect, Karl Rove and the Dream of Absolute Power, a subtitle which, by the way, was changed from the hardcover edition, The Master Plan for Absolute Power. Events have dictated a new subtitle.
In the last 2 weeks, two high-profile cases of cancer.
Past week, a new spotlight has been shone on this often incurable disease, with the back-to-back revelations that Elizabeth Edwards and White House spokesman Tony Snow's cancer is back.
Elizabeth Edwards suggested she was no different from thousands of others.
She made a wonderful comment. She said, you know, yesterday I found out that I had breast cancer. Another woman, she also found out yesterday, and she had to be at work at 8 o'clock this morning.
That's James Olson, history professor and author of Bathsheba's Breast, Women, Cancer, and History, written in part as a way to cope with the amputation of his hand and forearm due to cancer. He said he focused his research on breast cancer because for centuries, breast cancer was cancer, the only visible form, and it afflicted women who kept much better records of their experiences through letters and journals. Later, of course, other cancers were identified, tragedies kept secret behind closed doors. Occasionally, a window opened on the disease, on those rare occasions when famous Americans were afflicted and made it public, among them the enormously popular Ulysses S. Grant, who had just finished his presidency and was writing his memoirs when he was diagnosed with mouth cancer. His was a high-profile death. Then in 1893, Grover Cleveland was diagnosed.
They snuck President Cleveland off to a yacht in the East River in New York. They didn't want the news to get out because they were afraid it might rattle the stock market. They did surgery on him, gave him kind of an artificial jawbone. But Cleveland survived, and the news of his surgery didn't get out for a considerable time. But when it did, it became obvious that surgery had cured his cancer. And therefore, suddenly, for the first time, it wasn't just someone trying to shop a cure and make money off it. It really had worked.
in the 40s, there were several high-profile cancers, and this represented a kind of turning point. Can you tell us about the two Babes?
You know, Babe Ruth, the home run king for the New York Yankees, he had developed an image of somebody who was invincible. He drank, he caroused, and then he hit home runs with hangovers. And then he came down with a head and neck cancer in his throat. Ruth made a conscious decision to not hide it, not try to cover it up. And so the press moved in on his disease, and his disease was really more public than most people's had been in a long time since Ulysses S. Grant. Even more significant than that one, however, in the 1950s, the most prominent female athlete in American history, Babe Dietrichson Zaharias, came down with colon cancer.
She won two gold medals and one silver medal for track and field in the 1932 Los Angeles Olympics, and she played organized baseball, softball.
Great golfer. She had colon cancer, and colon cancer was always one of the more stigmatized of the cancers. It resurrects some of the very old-fashioned ideas about cancer being filthy. But Babe was quite public about it. She continued to play and win tournaments. Now, eventually, the colon cancer killed her. But America followed her death, and she was so forthright about it that, again, it's a celebrity who wasn't ashamed of having cancer.
But the disease still carried a social stigma, didn't it? Obituaries didn't refer to cancer as a cause of death.
Yeah, absolutely, there was a stigma to it. And it's interesting because people had long since known that it wasn't contagious, but the disease itself was so intractable. You know, it's a death sentence in a land of ice cream and sunshine where we're supposed to be able to solve all problems if we put our minds to it. And yet cancer's been very, very refractory is the term physicians use when chemotherapy doesn't work. For me, it's going to go back to Susan Sontag and that illness as metaphor and, you know, the fact that once we understood the cause of tuberculosis, tuberculosis rapidly lost its mystical power and its metaphors of filth and disgust because it was just a disease caused by, you know, a bacterium. Once we know more and more about the causes of cancer, I think the same thing is going to happen to it.
The American Cancer Society was founded in 1945. Do you think it had an impact on the image of the disease?
Oh, absolutely. What the American Cancer Society did is they widely distributed the 7 warning signs of cancer. And those warning signs were, you know, a lump in the breast, unexplained bleeding. And when you start talking about, you know, breast cancer and cervical cancer and colon cancer and so on, you're talking about bodily functions. So the very fact of creating that public health campaign, you know, you end up pulling the disease out of the closet a little bit and making it less shameful as a cultural or political phenomenon.
I know Barbara Ehrenreich has written with a certain amount of rancor on the power of positive thinking campaigns that would seem to place the blame for cancer on the victim.
Well, you know, that's a phenomenon that goes back to the end of the 1970s when I was, you know, first diagnosed with my sarcoma in 1981. You had a best-selling book out by a couple called the Simontons. And they alleged that you could deal with your own disease by imaging your body, by galvanizing your own immune system to fight the cancer. The problem with it is, if your cancer recurred, you blamed yourself. And that theory of a connection between somebody's emotional state and the outbreak of cancer, I'm not going to deny that there might be a connection. But my problem with that is that a lot of nickel and dime psychologists built cottage industries and then massive industries making money selling that notion to cancer patients.
So you watched the press over the last week as they covered both Elizabeth Edwards and Tony Snow. What do you think the coverage says about the evolution of attitudes towards the disease?
Well, personally, I'm very annoyed with people who sit in judgment of somebody else's decision. You know, I remember back in the 80s, President Reagan's wife, Nancy, came down with breast cancer, and she decided to have a mastectomy. And what happened was Mrs. Reagan was severely criticized from some people in the women's movement, saying that all she needed was a lumpectomy, and that by getting a mastectomy, she's set a bad example for other women. sit in judgment of someone's decision when you haven't been there and haven't had it just seems to me to be the height of arrogance.
Did it bother you at all that some of the discussion over the decision of the Edwards to continue with the campaign seemed to imply that she was going to fall ill and he would need to be there by her side?
Absolutely, yeah. The assumption is that the cancer is going to kill her and that by doing this, they're going to take away time from their children, that raw and rank ambition is trumping family values. What a crock. You know, it's just absurd. What is she supposed to do? What is the alternative? Is the alternative for her to just kind of go back and hide in her nice home in North Carolina and wait till it kills her? You'll live her life, which I think is the right of every cancer survivor to do.
It was a pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
James Olson is professor of history at Sam Houston State University and author of Bathsheba's Breast, Women, Cancer, and History.
This is On the Media from NPR.
On the Media is supported by the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org, the John D. and Catherine MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world, at macfound.org, and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. The pen of the editorial cartoonist often is the sharpest in the newsroom, and it's generally aimed at the jugular of all manner of politicians and institutions. But if a pictorial barb gores the wrong ox, it's likely to be spiked. David Wallace has collected some of the best of what was deemed not fit to print in his new book, Killed Cartoons. He says that offending people is part of the job of the cartoonist, but it's a job that's getting harder to do.
Unquestionably, there are ebbs and flows. During the McCarthy years, newspapers got really nervous and certainly put a clamp down on their editorial artists. I think post 9/11, we've seen a rebirth of not necessarily McCarthyism, but McCarthyism light. And I can think of an example recently. During the Iraq War in 2003, Mike Lukovich did an important cartoon that was killed by the Atlantic Journal-Constitution. And it was spelling out the words W lied using little military coffins. And that image was spiked. And then 2 years later, he was given more of a green light when the war became less popular. He meticulously handwrote each name of all the soldiers who had died at that point to mark the 2000th death in Iraq, spelling out the word why with a question mark. And that cartoon ran, and he won a Pulitzer Prize for his body of work last year.
Politics is a big reason why editorial cartoons get spiked. But as you note in your book, there are a number of other reasons, that basically amount to taste. That cartoon about the naked Uncle Sam was done by Mike Keefe. It was spiked, and it was called Electile Dysfunction.
And his penis was, I hope I can say the word penis, it was shaped like the map of Florida. It was a cartoon that Mike Keefe knew, of the Denver Post, knew was not going to run. And I understand the reasons why you don't necessarily want that cartoon in your morning paper. What was interesting about that cartoon was Mike Keefe learning to test the limits and to find out how far he could push his editor in order to then, you know, maybe pull back and do a drawing that would pass muster.
Obviously, a major job of the cartoonist is to offend the powerful. But you argue that American culture is turning non-offensive?
We used to have a lot of two paper towns. Now we have nothing but pretty much one paper towns, except for a few cities. Rather than allowing their cartoonists to have more freedom, newspapers are now more worried about trying to be all things to all people. I think that's what's gone on. You know, they've shown an incredible abdication of their duties, newspapers, in the last 10 years or so, certainly since the Republican Revolution, quote unquote, in 1994, to skewer the powerful.
I was surprised to see that in 1968, Look magazine killed an editorial cartoon by, of all people, Norman Rockwell.
You know, there's a lot of illustrators who think Rockwell is sentimental and not really a cutting-edge artist. But after the Civil Rights Movement, he was a very important voice working for Look magazine. And I think he really was doing brave work, in my opinion. And his cartoon is illustration, really. It's an illustration of a dead black soldier next to a white soldier, and they're bleeding together in Vietnam. And he originally had created the same image, but they were a dead white youth and a dead black youth in a ghetto. And somehow this scared Look magazine, and they wouldn't run either in the end. They asked him to put it in Vietnam, probably a safer context, Vietnam, than the ghetto in the 60s. And they ended up not running it. And I think it's a pretty profound image.
When you talk about surefire subjects that will get your cartoon killed.
Religion.
Religion every time?
Often. Abortion, religion, corporate power, cartoons about the newspaper industry, that'll get killed. But religion and race are probably the big two. In my book, I have a cartoon by Graham Mackay of the Hamilton Spectator in Canada of Pope John Paul II going towards heaven through the skies in a golden Pope mobile, sun-kissed clouds, and it's just really a reverent cartoon. But apparently, it didn't genuflect enough for his editor because they killed it as too whimsical, an image after the Pope's death. I mean, I couldn't think of a more innocuous, praiseworthy cartoon than that one.
You note in the book that newspapers have thinned the ranks of editorial cartoonists. You know, they don't investigate political crimes. They didn't uncover the truth about Enron. They just opine like myriad newspaper columnists, one voice among many. Why should we care whether editorial cartoonists are losing their jobs?
These opiners have actually been very important in our society. In the Vietnam era, for instance, we watched people like Paul Zepp and David Levine do a very famous illustration of LBJ pulling up his shirt and showing a scar in the shape of Vietnam. And that was considered a very, very important image that was burned in people's minds. And that's what it is about cartoonists. They are burned in people's minds. They affect us. They, in some ways, poke us in the eyes from the static pages of newspapers and magazines. So I would argue that they're pretty important.
David, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Brooke.
David Wallace is the author of Killed Cartoons, Casualties from the War on Free Expression.
In 1965 came the CBS debut of Hogan's Heroes, a sitcom based unexpectedly in a Nazi prisoner of war camp. The popular show had a 6-year run in spite of initial controversy on taste grounds. Many objected to the portrayal of German captors as good-natured buffoons, not to mention trivializing the horrors of Nazi Germany. Well, now, 42 years later, a new cable channel debuts, and with it, a sitcom sure to raise similar questions. The show is called Jihad to Be There, billed, and this is a quote from the press release, as a madcap romp through a terrorist training camp set in the primitive tribal north of Pakistan. Joining us to explain the show is Rex Van Ameren, the Senior Vice President for Programming on the brand new Terror Channel, which will, again, the press release, explode onto your television screen later this fall. Rex, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Bob. It's great to be here.
Okay, first of all, the Terror Channel.
Well, I was in Fiji recently and picked up a local paper there, and you know what the top story was? Terror. It's the same thing everywhere, and I don't think it's an exaggeration to say that it's a central fact of 21st century life. So if there's a golf channel and a speed channel, why shouldn't there be a terror channel?
And what kind of shows exactly will you produce?
Well, we've got a syndication deal with the producers of the Fox Hit 24. We've got a morning program lined up called Confiscated. We're doing this in cooperation with the Transportation Security Administration. It'll include videos of security checkpoints at airports. And you'll see some of the most astonishing things that travelers try to get past screeners.
That's potentially funny. Such as what?
Well, how about a baby orangutan or a jar of human eyeballs? We also have a hilarious one from Wilmington, North Carolina, with a surface-to-air missile.
A missile?
You can't make this stuff up.
Okay, let's talk about jihad to be there. What could possibly be funny about a terrorist training camp?
Well, you'd be surprised. The characters in Jihad to Be There are really the gang that couldn't shoot straight. The key is they're very bad terrorists. They're a bunch of bungling kooks and malcontents who just happen to want to kill Westerners. But they could just as easily be the gang from Taxi or Welcome Back, Kotter. Those shows that were successful because they had the ethnic New Yorker, the Jew, the Italian. We're hoping to recreate that kind of success with the ethnic Middle Easterner.
The main character's name is Abdul, a Saudi dentistry student who is obsessed with blowing up the Golden Gate Bridge. Can you see, Rex, how that might not be all that amusing to the residents of San Francisco or Saudi Arabia, for that matter?
Well, Bob, actually all the characters are named Abdul. It's kind of a running joke of the show, and in the opening episode, the mullah commands, "Abdul, your bomb belt," and everybody springs up to grab their explosives, and they all knock heads. "Abdul, your bomb belt." Every sixth grader in America will be saying it, I guarantee it.
Any backlash yet from the Muslim community or from the U.S. government about this kind of brazen ridicule and stereotyping?
Bob, we have no intention of ridiculing anyone's religion. As President Bush said himself, Islam is a beautiful religion, and it is. But at the same time, you have to be a little edgy. You have these goofy beards and hats and death to this, death to that, and that spells an opportunity for comedy, which is exactly what we plan to deliver.
All right, Rex. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Rex Van Ameren is Senior Vice President of the Terror Channel.
Sunday is April 1st, a popular day for hoaxes in American journalism, a tradition that dates back to the mid-19th century. Popular then, not so much nowadays. In the current issue of the Columbia Journalism Review, author Robert Love chronicles some of the more memorable ink-stained hoaxes in newspaperdom. He says that one of the oldest was perpetrated in a series of articles in the original New York Sun.
The Great Moon Hoax of 1835 was a series of articles in the New York Sun. It was about the exploits of an astronomer named Sir John Herschel, a real man, who found fantastic things when looking through this 24-foot telescope at the Cape of Good Hope. And what he found was men on the moon.
What he says about those lunar humanoids was that they, quote, averaged 4 feet in height, were covered with short and glossy copper-colored hair, and had wings composed of a thin membrane lying snugly upon their backs. Now, Bob, someone put a lot of thought into this hoax. There were 6 very long and detailed articles. At what point did the Sun say, just kidding?
You know, the Sun really never did fully admit that this was a hoax. And the prevailing attitude among journalists who were hoaxers at the time was that if people were credulous enough to believe it, so there.
Did the New York Sun's readership ever express skepticism?
First of all, the hoax worked. And in general, hoaxes worked very well in the 19th century, doing what publishers always want to do, which is bring in more eyeballs. Did people ever sort of rise up in revolt against what they thought was fake news? The answer is no. Hoaxes became part of newspaperdom's menu of entertainment. Nobody really thought the worst of the papers for doing it. In some cases, they would reveal at the last line that this was all made up. Sometimes it would took place on, you know, April 1st. But many times, it never did.
What about the much vaunted relationship of trust between reporters and readers? Did that not matter back then?
Well, I mean, that's a hard question to answer. But the truth is that sometime after the first couple of decades of the 20th century, newspapers began to acquire the mantle of authority, almost a quasi-governmental source of truth about what was going on. To a large part, that didn't exist for many papers in the mid-19th century. There was news. It was often biased. It was often kind of like some of the news you get today in certain outlets that have a kind of slant to them one way or the other. And people understood that.
Tell me about the Central Park Zoo hoax in the New York Herald in the 1870s.
The Central Park Zoo hoax is one of the most famous hoaxes in the great landscape of media hoaxes. And there's a rumor that the publisher said he could keep every New Yorker indoors just by publishing a story like this one day. And somebody said, I'll take you up on that bet. But what happened was, on November 9th, 1874, the Herald talked about a Central Park Zoo escape. There was a lion seen inside a church. A rhinoceros had fallen into the river. The National Guard was called out, and I believe it was 27 people were already dead and hundreds injured. The paper called it a, quote, bloody and fearful carnival, and that the animals were still on the loose. People started reading this article, and they just set out to defend themselves, their homes, and their families. But at the very end of it, it said, the entire story given above is pure fabrication.
Sounds like a million laughs.
So, and the point of it was, if a hoax needs a higher moral point, it was that the conditions of the animals at the zoo and their cages was thought to be not up to snuff by these crusading reporters.
What's the deal with all the hoaxes in New York City? Is it just that that's where some of the biggest papers were, or is there something about the nature of this city that lends itself to it?
Well, more papers, I think. Brooke, also, we have better records of the old newspapers in New York than we do elsewhere. There were thousands of hoaxes that are unrecorded in small newspapers throughout the West, especially in the 19th century. Many of them were about finding the remains of a petrified man. This was a hoax that became such a cliche that Mark Twain himself set out to shatter it by writing the best petrified man story he could.
A hardy perennial.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of history's most peculiar and most persistent hoaxes, you note in your story, was by H.L. Mencken, but not in Baltimore, where he was most famous for working. It was in the New York Evening Mail in 1917, and it was headlined, A Neglected Anniversary.
Mencken's neglected anniversary was the natural history of the plumbed bathtub in America. It was so well constructed, so well written, that it was quoted in sources high and low from then on. It stated that a man named Adam Thompson had become acquainted with the tub in Europe and had brought one here, and it had been basically roundly poo-pooed by Americans. But finally, President Millard Fillmore, going against the political grain, bravely ordered one put into the White House, and from then on, the bathtub was an American institution. Of course, all of this is completely made up.
He claimed that the city of Boston made it illegal to bathe except, quote, under medical advice. He said that here the bathtub was denounced as an Epicurean and obnoxious toy from England designed to corrupt the democratic simplicity of the republic.
Well, it's interesting that recent surveys have found out that too much use of a bathtub can do all those things and more.
Weaken the simplicity of the republic?
Kidding.
You know, we did some digging and found that President Truman, in a 1952 speech in Philadelphia at the American Hospital Association convention, repeated parts of Mencken's story as fact.
The local medical association in Cincinnati, Ohio, passed resolutions calling Mrs. Fillmore an indecent person because she had put a bathtub in the White House. This medical association in Cincinnati said that it was unsanitary, that it was unhealthy, that no person should take all his clothes off at one time.
That sounds right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Robert Love is an adjunct professor at the Columbia Graduate School of Journalism. His article in the current issue of CJR will be linked to at onthemedia.org.
Ladies and gentlemen, I have a grave announcement to make. Incredible as it may seem, both the observations of science and the evidence of our eyes lead to the inescapable assumption that those strange beings who landed in the Jersey farmlands tonight are the vanguard of an invading army from the planet Mars. The battle which took place tonight at Grover Mills has ended in one of the most startling defeats ever suffered by an army in modern times. 7,000 men armed with rifles and machine guns pitted against a single fighting machine of the invaders from Mars. 120 known survivors. The rest strewn over the battle area from Grover's Mill to Plainsboro, crushed and trampled to death under the metal feet of the monster, or burned to cinders by its heat ray.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, Mike Volo, and Nazanin Rafsanjani, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Christopher Worth, Peter Garner, and Andy Lancet. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.